Well, good morning, everyone. The intrepid few. This is, we never know quite what's going to happen with this Rohatsu retreat, because we've just recently done our big week-long session out at Loon Lake in Maple Ridge. And yet somehow it feels important to mark Rohatsu, the ostensible anniversary of Buddha's enlightenment. We don't really know how historically accurate that is. But all over the world, in Zen monasteries and practice centers, monks and lay people gather to sit, usually for a full week, session, in a kind of ritual reenactment of Siddhartha Gautama's resolve to sit under the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening, also called the sacred fig tree, until he realized the truth of existence, until he understood the cause of human suffering and the way to freedom from suffering. December 8th is traditionally celebrated as Bodhi Day, Awakening Day, Enlightenment Day, but we're a lay sangha, and so we have to make use of weekends. So here we are, after the snowstorm, which didn't turn out to be quite as much of a snowstorm as predicted, but still, I'm glad conditions today are a little better than yesterday's, and that you all got here safe and sound. So this is kind of like part two of our yearly session at Loon Lake, which wasn't a full week. It was 6 days, five full days. So this is like the second installment, doing the final day, night, and morning of what would be a Rohatsu session if we had it exactly in the right time. So I'm glad that some of you who couldn't be there for Loon Lake can be there for this part, be here for this part. But none of us have been sitting in retreat this past week, right? We've come from our busy lives with our work and family responsibilities, with the residues of that busyness in our bodies and minds. And we're not in a remote mountain monastery. We're in a storefront zendo on Wall Street. But we can sit together this weekend doing this simple ancient practice taught by the Buddha. And we can renew our determination and take courage from the many generations of Dharma ancestors before us and from each other. And some of us will sit into the night, through the night, which is the tradition for the last night of Rohatsu, sitting through the night as the Buddha did. Session is what we call an intensive Zen retreat, and it's a combination of two characters, Chinese or Japanese characters, setsu, which means to touch, and shin, which means both heart and mind. I really love that Asian way of combining heart and mind, not separating them. And of course, that ultimately includes body as well, because our mind is, believe it or not just located up here. Our mind is located throughout our body and beyond. And that's something that we get to touch deeply, touching that heart, mind, body that extends beyond what we usually consider ourself. And the way we do that is by paying attention, simply paying attention to our moment-to-moment experience. Sensations, perceptions, thoughts, emotions arise and pass away. And as we do this practice, just patiently, persistently, hour after hour, we begin to experience directly, not just intellectually, the truths of impermanence, of no self, which means no separate self, which means self only in relationship to everything, in the matrix of everything. We get to experience directly suffering and cessation of suffering. You know how you can just be absolutely miserable sitting in Sesshin and then it dissolves. It's gone. Where did it go? Where did it go, that intense emotion or that repetitive thought? We may only glimpse these truths, or sometimes we crack wide open. And then we go back to our everyday lives and we practice everyday Zen. Awakening in our work and family lives, walking down a city street, riding a bus, looking out at the snowy mountains, feeling the stillness beneath the urban clamor. I think most of you know at least the basic outlines of the Buddha's life story. It's sort of like the Christmas story, in that it's an enduring tale, you know, that's been told and embellished over centuries, over 2,000 years. And like the life story of Jesus of Nazareth, who became known as the Christ, the story of Siddhartha Gautama, who became known as the Buddha, has elements of miraculous birth, greatness foretold, trials, temptations, and betrayals, times of solitude and meditation, times of practicing in spiritual community. All those parallels. Did you ever think of that? For those of you who grew up in the tradition and know the Christian story, there are quite a lot of parallels. Except the Buddha guy went on to live and teach until he was in his early 80s. Big difference there. And for as much as both Jesus Christ and Gautama Buddha have been deified over the centuries, their stories contain much that is human. And they tell us much about ourselves. So I want to kind of give you some of the flavor of the story of Buddha's enlightenment as it appears as it's told in one of the versions, or the main version that has come down to us. You know, the Pali Canon, which is the earliest written suttas, texts, was only one of any number of canons. It's the one that survived. It became the most popular. So this is one version of the Buddha's story. So as you know, Siddhartha Gautama, was his given name, Gautama was his clan name, family name, was born the son of a regional king in ancient India. A soothsayer predicted that he would become either a great king or a great sage and teacher. So of course his father wanted him to ensure that his son became his heir, following his footsteps. So he had Siddhartha raised in great luxury and restricted to the palace grounds. And it was not until Siddhartha was a young man, married with a young child, that he became restless and curious to see what was beyond the palace walls, what was in the world outside. So on four successive days, he went out with his charioteer and met what are called the four messengers. First day, he met a sick man covered in sores. Next day, he met an old man or woman, frail and alone. Third day, he saw a corpse by the roadside. He was deeply shocked and appalled to realize that this was the fate of every human being on earth. How could he not have known there was such suffering in the world? And finally, on the fourth day, he saw a holy man sitting in meditation who looked deeply peaceful. And Siddhartha realized that he would have to leave his home, his wife, and his child in search of a way to live in this world of suffering. So we are like Siddhartha, right? Each of us comes to spiritual practice out of some realization of human suffering. For some, it's a personal experience. Most of us it is, I think. For some, it comes early in life. For some, later. Sometimes it takes us a while to realize our own suffering. Sometimes we focus more on the suffering around us in the world. And we have a kind of blind spot for our own suffering. Most of us have led relatively protected lives. You know, kind of contemporary version of the Buddhas. Compared to many people in this world, we've been very protected. But at some point, we have a close encounter with sickness, old age, or death. Or it may be a close experience of human cruelty and injustice that wakes us up to suffering and arouses what's called our way-seeking mind, bodhicitta. Way-seeking mind is the motivation to practice not only for oneself, but for others, for the whole world. So what was it for you? Was it a sudden awareness of suffering, or gradual, personal, or external? What awakened your way-seeking mind? And in some way, maybe we don't, you know, leave our family and wife or a child as the Buddha did, but in some way, there's a home leaving. There's a letting go of the old and opening to a new way of being. And what has that been for you? What's your version of home leaving? I don't know about you, but the suffering in the world has felt particularly close for me in recent weeks and months, for reasons I don't think I need to remind you of. There are plenty. You can each make your own list of what's, you know, gone deeply in for you. And yet all over the world, right in the midst of such suffering, are courageous, ordinary people saying, no, we don't want to live life that way. We want to find a way to live with some peace and harmony with each other and the other beings on this earth. The earth herself. So this is a good time, you know, as the year closes in these dark days, to renew our bodhisattva vows, to arouse our bodhicitta, the motivation to awaken. And, you know, for ourselves, for others, to whatever extent we awaken, it automatically is of benefit to others. That's really the only way we can do it. And with all other beings. So when Siddhartha set out on his quest, he first sought out the best teachers of meditation he could find. He wanted to learn how to meditate. It's often what let's learn how to meditate so life won't be so hard. So that's what he did. And because he was young and keen, he practiced really, really hard. And he achieved great proficiency in concentration, you know, really strong concentration. But after a while, he realized that he didn't really understand how that could relieve suffering. He felt he hadn't, something he hadn't. He didn't have the freedom. So he wandered to a remote forest where he decided to practice all by himself. And like all of us, he ran into fear. So I want to read you just a little bit. He went to a place where there were shrines. It says orchard shrines, woodland shrines, and tree shrines. It's a, probably sort of an animistic tradition of worshipping spirits of groves and trees in ancient India. But it was also a place that, that many people found scary. So he challenged himself to do this, to go sit in a place that many people found scary. And he said, and while I dwelt there, a deer would approach me, or a peacock would knock off a branch, or the wind would rustle the leaves. Then I thought, surely this is fear and dread coming. And then he says, I thought, why do I dwell in constant expectation of the fear and dread? How many of us do that? You know? Roy, what's going to come next? He's realizing here how much he's suffering just from not an actual threat, but from his anticipation of fear and dread, or for that matter, any other kind of suffering. Most often, we're suffering anxiety from anticipating, right? Anticipating what's going to happen next rather than what's actually happening. The human capacities for memory and foresight are both a blessing and a curse, it seems. So how did he deal with this arising of fear and dread, or anticipating fear and dread? He stayed fully present. He says, whether he was sitting or standing or walking or lying down, he didn't try to escape. He didn't try to change his posture until the fear had subsided. He breathed and he let go its grip on the fear. It can feel like we are gripped by fear when actually we are the ones gripping the fear. And so we release. We release our grip. He mentions the four postures, and that's something that we encourage people to do during yaza, like later on tonight, to alternate your postures, sitting, standing, walking, and lying down, the four noble postures, which is a wonderful practice to do. So Siddhartha also ran up against the persistence of his own mental activity, as we all do when we sit down to meditate. And being young and determined, he tried to control his mind by force. So this is what he did. This is written in his voice. Right? Suppose, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush my mind with my mind. Then, as a strong man might seize a weaker by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Sweat ran from my armpits while I did so. Have you ever sat like that? Yeah. I call that gritted teeth Zen. It can only take us so far. You know, sometimes I think we kind of have to do that. Just to convince ourselves that ultimately it doesn't work. That we can't force our mind into submission. He says, though tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness established, yet my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful effort. Familiar? Have you ever done? So there's got to be another way. But he tried first even harder, even more extreme forms of practice. He said, he tried. Suppose I practice the meditation that is without breathing. Talk about breath practice. I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths in my mouth and nose. When I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming from my ear holes, as there is a loud sound when a smith's bellows are blown. I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths in my mouth and nose and ears. When I did so, violent winds racked my head, and if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword, as if, and there were violent pains in my head, as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband. So he tried that. Didn't work too well. He also tried extreme fasting. Have you ever seen in Buddhist art those pictures of the emaciated Buddha, the ribs showing? So he was really, really determined. There's a rather ghastly depiction of what he did, of his body. After fasting like that, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems because of eating so little. My backside became like a camel's hoof. The projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. My ribs jutted out as gaunt and as crazy rafters, the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn, and the gleam of my eyes sunk far down in their sockets. Like a gleam of water sunk down in a deep well. My scalp shriveled and withered as a green gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun, etc. So this is the first point where Mara is the kind of a demon and a tempter who appears to Siddhartha. This is the first point when Mara appears. And he comes on with a kind of show of pity. He says, oh, you are thin and you are pale and you are in death's presence too. 1,000 parts are pledged to death, but life still holds one part of you. Live, sir. Life is the better way. You can gain merit if you live. Come, live the holy life and pour libations on the holy fires, and thus a world of merit gain. What can you do by struggling now? The path of struggling is too tough. Too rough and difficult and hard to bear. So he's giving him an out. He's saying, why don't you be like one of the ordinary priests, whatever the spiritual tradition was there at the time, making offerings to get personal merit for a better rebirth. That's what he's suggesting. Forget these extreme meditation practices. Why don't you just get some merit the easy way? And Siddhartha was not tempted. He said, now merit I need not at all. Let Mara talk of merit then to those that stand in need of it, and in need of it, for I have faith and energy and I have understanding too. So he He could not be tempted, but he was exhausted at this point, absolutely exhausted from striving, and he was reduced to skin and bones, near starvation, and he still had not experienced the kind of freedom he wanted. So he asked himself if there could be another way. And at this point, he remembered an experience from childhood. His father was taking a kind of ceremonial role in a seasonal agricultural festival in the fields. And the young Siddhartha sat on the sidelines. He was probably a little bored. And sat under a rose apple tree. And he naturally fell into a state of simple meditative presence, full presence and peace, without striving at all. I think that's, you know, for a number of us, when we first start meditation practice, there's something familiar about it because we experience it at some point, often outdoors in nature. You know, it's our birthright. It's a natural state to be quiet and receptive and open. And children can access that if they have a chance. So recalling this feeling, he realized he'd gone too far in his extreme practices. And he decided to take some food and realized that he was not doing so for pleasure, but to support his ability to meditate with some ease. He'd fallen into the trap, which is not uncommon in spiritual seekers, of seeing the body and its needs as an enemy to be subdued. The story goes that a milkmaid mistook him for a tree deity. She was bringing an offering of something like rice pudding to the tree deity, and she thought that he was the deity and offered him the food. And he had five companions who saw this and rejected him, saying he was giving up the struggle, becoming self-indulgent. But after gaining some strength from this food, Siddhartha took up his place beneath the Bodhi tree, and he vowed not to leave until he had achieved enlightenment. Now, now comes two kind of famous passages about Mara tempting the Buddha or Siddhartha. And in the earliest accounts of his encounter with Mara, these incidents happen before and then after his enlightenment experience, rather than on the night itself. But in the best known version, the two episodes are combined and depicted as incurring during his final night of sitting under the Bodhi tree. It makes a more dramatic story, I think. So in the first, Mara and his armies assault Siddhartha. In the second, Mara's daughters tried to tempt him, all without success. Now, even though we haven't been sitting sesshin this past week, chances are we've all been visited by a familiar demon or two at some point in the past week. Greed, desire, fear, envy, to name a few possibilities. And in sesshin, these demons can rise up quite vividly and intensely. So I think it's helpful to see how Mara behaves and how we can meet him when he shows up. Notice I'm not saying vanquish him, I'm saying meet him. Even the Buddha himself did not vanquish Mara once and for all on that night of his enlightenment. Mara appeared to him repeatedly through his life, and that's another story that I won't include now, but it seems almost as though they developed a lifelong relationship, even a sort of friendly recognition towards the end. which I think can serve as a model for us. Mara is usually depicted as a fierce demonic figure, sometimes with 100 arms riding on an elephant. But he's also a trickster. He can take on various forms and guises. And I've been calling him he, or referring to him as he, because that's how he is traditionally represented, but you can easily imagine Mara with male and female aspects. And I suspect that we all have male and female Maras within us. Stephen Batchelor wrote an excellent book called Living with the Devil, A Meditation on Good and Evil. And he says, Mara stands for those patterns of behavior that long for the security of clinging to something real and permanent, rather than facing the question posed by being a transient and contingent creature. It makes no difference what you grasp, said the Buddha. When someone grasps, Mara stands beside him. So Mara is that desperate longing for a self and a world that are comprehensible, manageable, and safe. Unfortunately, so that kind of clinging turns into a kind of death. As its hold tightens, or our hold on it tightens, we feel as though our life itself is being stifled and snuffed out. So the function of Mara, his job, is to hinder us, to prevent us from experiencing freedom. Freedom from the delusion that we are permanent, separate, self-entities. Mara wants to convince us that we're really safer and more secure if we hold on to and defend our fixed ideas of who we are. He's afraid that if we let go of self-clinging, he's going to be out of a job. The image of Siddhartha and Mara that is most often represented in Indian art is of Siddhartha sitting steadfast under the Bodhi tree as he's assailed by these armies of Mara. So this is Siddhartha speaking to Mara. He says, your first squadron is sense desires. Your second is called boredom. Then hunger and thirst compose the third, and craving is the fourth. The fifth is sloth and acidity. Do you know that word? Acidity, acidia. It's a kind of, it's not quite depression. It's more like apathy. Yeah, it's a kind of flatness. While cowardice lines up as the sixth, uncertainty is the seventh, the eighth is malice paired with obstinacy, gain, honor, and renown, besides an ill-won notoriety. Self-praise and denigrating others, these are your squadrons, Mara. None but the brave will conquer them to gain bliss by the victory. I fly the ribbon that denies retreat. Shame on life here, I say. Better I die in battle now than choose to live on in defeat. There are ascetics and Brahmins that have surrendered here, and they are seen no more. They do not know the paths the pilgrim travels by. So seeing Mara's squadrons now arrayed all around with elephants, I sally forth to fight, that I may not be driven from my post. So it's quite a kind of martial attitude he's taking here towards Mara's temptations. It's a bit of almost a hard quality. He insists he'd rather die in battle than yield to Mara's temptations. And yet, this probably reflects the culture of his time. I mean, he was raised in a military culture by his father, right? How different is that from our own times? Not very. We still believe, our culture still believes, we need to battle our enemies. You know, or we still think we need to battle our inner and outer enemies. So this is a very human Siddhartha. Actually, I find kind of a moving passage because it depicts a young man struggling with these very strong arisings. What a list, right? We could each make our own list. So it does make sense to me that this assault would have occurred. In a way, it makes more sense to me, though, that this assault would have occurred before he sat down beneath the Bodhi tree, as some versions tell it. Because when he sat down beneath the Bodhi tree, he was more letting go of that kind of striving. But Mara does not give up easily. Again, in this more commonly told story, after the armies are defeated, Mara sends his beautiful daughters to tempt Siddhartha. Their names are Tanha, Arati, and Naga, craving, boredom, and lechery. But in the less known story, this happens after the Buddha's enlightenment. And I kind of like this better too. After the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara searches for him for 7 years and finds him sitting in solitary meditation by a river. The reason I like this version better is it portrays a human Buddha subject to doubt after 7 years of wandering and teaching. Yeah, maybe he's getting a little tired. He's not too sure, you know. How's this going? Am I on the right path here? So Mara shows up with these women, right? Beautiful women. Well, actually, they transform themselves into every possible kind of female beauty. And Mara shows up. Finding the Buddha by the river and says, "Do you now dream in woods immersed in sorrow? Have you lost wealth or are you pining for it? Is there some crime done by you in the town? Why do you make no friends among the people? And is there none that you can call a friend?" Buddha replies, "The root of sorrow is dug out of me. Unsorrowing, I meditate in innocence. And free of hindrance, O cousin of the careless," he calls Mara, "O cousin of the careless." Mara says, "The things of which men say, 'It is mine,' and men who utter the word, 'mine,' if you have thoughts allied to these, you cannot escape me, monk." The Buddha says, "Things they call mine, I call not so. I am not one of those so saying. Hear this then, evil one, the path I know you cannot even see." So they have this back and forth dialogue. That actually happens before the daughters show up. Then the daughters show up and tempt the Buddha with every possible female version of beauty. And at the end of all this, Mara, this is a little description I really like. Mara is discouraged. He says, "Step by step for 7 years, I have followed the Blessed One, the fully enlightened one, possessed of mindfulness, gave me no chance." Then he left that place and sat down cross-legged on the ground, not far from the Buddha, silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and with nothing to say, scraping the ground with a stick. So that's a pretty, pathetic demon at this point. Going back to the Bodhi tree version of the story, there's one final temptation where Mara gets fed up and mocks Siddhartha, saying, "Who do you think you are to think that you can be the enlightened one? I'm the most enlightened one here anyway." And the demon hordes all shouted, "Yes, yes, we'll bear witness to that." How many of you have an internal Mara who says, "Who do you think you are?" Yeah. Who do you think you are to think you can, you know, publish something or put on the Buddha's robe or speak in front of 100 people or produce a piece of art or, you know, who do you think you are? You know that voice? That's Mara. That is definitely Mara. Mara functions as what we, you know, it's been called the inner critic. And the voice of the inner critic can be a powerful and habitual presence in our lives, right? So we really need to call on our clear-seeing Dharma eye to see Mara at work and to identify Mara's voice. So again, Mara mocks Siddhartha, saying, "Who do you have to witness for you?" "No one." And at this, Siddhartha touches the earth with his right hand, and you may have seen this in images, and says, "The earth will be my witness." And at that, the earth quakes and opens up, and an earth goddess rises up out of the earth and wrings out her hair and causes a flood which washes away all Mara's demon armies. I have always loved this image of the Buddha touching the earth. "The earth will be my witness." So many times when I find myself assailed by the demons of fear or doubt or longing, I've reached for the earth to steady and still my heart and mind and to remember my true being. I imagine some of you have done that as well. But really, ultimately, Mara cannot exist without Buddha, and Buddha cannot exist without Mara. Stephen Batchelor, in his book, calls Mara Buddha's devilish twin. He says, Buddha needs to let go of Mara in order to be Buddha. And not just once, as an episode in the heroic drama of enlightenment. As long as Buddha lives, he is constantly relinquishing Mara. For Mara is the self to Buddha's selflessness, the fear to Buddha's fearlessness, the death to Buddha's deathlessness. The two are inseparable. Nirvana and samsara, light and darkness, how can there be one without the other? So if even the Buddha was accompanied by Mara, his shadow, all his life, how do we live with Mara? Kind of encouraging, really, to think that even the Buddha lived with Mara his whole life. Well, the best way is to do what the Buddha did, to meet Mara and see him clearly. Not to suppress the arisings of Mara. That's what Siddhartha tried earlier, right? Gritted teeth. Yeah. But to sit steadfast in body and mind and penetrate Mara's delusion of the permanent solid self. We don't need to hate Mara or ourselves for being vulnerable to Mara's temptations. We don't need to suppress, dispel, avoid, deny, analyze, or distract ourselves. Nor should we melodramatically indulge or mindlessly vent our Mara states. But we do apply patience and kindness as we allow these states to arise and shift and open and even disperse completely in the light of awareness. Our initial encounters with Mara when we're young can be pretty fraught and conflictual. At various times throughout our lives, our demons may be powerful. Lust, ambition, self-loathing, shame, or the more subtly debilitating apathy, doubt, despair. But over time, we can actually befriend our demons. They can become our allies. Mara continued, as I said, to appear throughout the Buddha's life, even as he approached death. And in later stories, they seem almost like old friends. Mara, just checking in. The Buddha's saying, oh yeah, I see you, Mara. I see you. That's what he always said. I see you, Mara. I remain firm in my practice. So Mara serves as the Buddha's shadow. And you know, if you read any Jungian psychology, you know, it works deeply with our shadow side. Often we discover our own shadow in the things that really annoy or threaten us about somebody else. The thing that really bothers us in that person is something that somehow we've banished from our own being that we don't want to look at in ourselves. Because our shadow is what we've learned is unacceptable. Right? But it's there in the shadows. And we may have banished fear or anger or desire, but sometimes we banish a bright side of ourselves. Sometimes we banish our playfulness, you know, our intelligence or joy. Sometimes we put them in the shadow. When we become deeply acquainted with the shadow side, we often discover that what's in the shadow contains a kernel of vital, creative, and beneficial energy. Even in those characteristics that we most reject in ourselves and others. So we could go as far as to say that Mara actually has gifts to offer us. Because it is through the very suffering Mara imposes on us that we transform our hindrances into Dharma gates, and then we step through. We let go of craving and we open to compassion and care. We let go of aversion and we open to wisdom. We let go of fear, we open to joy. There's no part of our experience, there's nothing in the shadow that cannot be transformed and open to freedom. So as we sit together this weekend, reenacting that archetypal heroic story of the Buddha's great enlightenment, let's take heart in knowing that even for the Buddha, enlightenment wasn't some once and for all done deal. As long as he continued to live in an embodied human life, in the midst of a world of samsara, of sickness, old age, and death, of human cruelty and injustice, awakening was something he had to continually practice and actualize in each moment, just as we do. So, you know, it's a heroic story. And yet, it's not beyond our reach. I think to take up this simple practice of just paying attention to our own lives is a heroic thing to do in our world, a radical thing to do in our world, because there's so much in the world that tells us not to pay attention. So please take courage from each other, as I've said, and from our ancestors, and meet whatever comes with an open mind and heart as we sit through the coming hours. And we might not see the morning star as the Buddha did, but when dawn comes, whether you're here in the Zendo or at home, pause for a moment and think of the Buddha looking up at the morning star. Okay. So thanks. I've gone on pretty long. Thank you for listening.
May our intention equally